This is going to be episode one of the Rise with Levine podcast, and we're with Brian Williams, who I know quite a bit about, but the audience may or may not know you. So why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself, what you do, and really just what you're all about, man.
Okay. Well, my name is Brian Wesley Williams. I'm from Los Angeles, California. Currently what I'm doing, I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a personal trainer, massage therapist. I do photography, videography, a lot of storytelling, but within photography, I do a lot of fitness, beauty, fashion, and a lot of corporate events.
Yeah.
As far as photography goes. I do a lot of coverage for a lot of companies.
Right.
And for videography, I do a lot of marketing for a lot of influencers, small corporations, and you know, some people who need some type of empowerment.
Right,
you know,
right.
An image of themselves that they'd never seen before. They hired me to use my creativity to project them in a way that they'd never seen themselves before.
Yeah.
So, for as personal training go, I've focused on athletic training.
Okay.
And for massage therapy, I do myofascial release. So my education is actually geography. I went to Arizona State, and I studied geography, but I moved back to Los Angeles doing aerospace engineering.
Right.
So I did that for a year, and you know, I got laid off, and from there I went into personal training, and at that time I was doing modeling and acting. So when I was doing modeling and acting, I was a model for Peak Models and Movement Talent Agency down the street up in North Hollywood.
Yeah, I've heard of them.
Yeah, so like they really propelled my acting modeling career by booking me a lot of jobs. I did a lot of Hallmark commercials. And I did some Nike commercials, Adidas commercials, and I was able to accumulate enough capital where I was able to start my own production company, which is Aesthetics LLC.
Amazing, man. Amazing. So I remember you talking about the Nike commercial. Tell me about that process, what it was like from the audition to if there was a callback, if you were booked off your look, if you were booked off a photo. How did that work with the Nike commercial? Because I know how my, you know, booking some commercials has worked on my end, and the process could be competitive.
Yeah, competitive. Very competitive.
Man, so tell me a little bit about the process of you booking a Nike commercial, because to me, Hallmark is awesome, but Nike as athletes, that's like top tier vibe right there. So tell me about the Nike commercial a little bit.
So when I went to Arizona State, I was running track at Arizona State, and we were national champions. My event is 100 meters, 200 meters, and you know, everybody know each other. You know, I knew athletes at USC, UCLA, Oregon is an extremely popular school when it comes to track and field. So a lot of those, some of those coaches, they live in LA.
Right.
And they know all the athletes and they know who's graduating and stuff like that. So after college, there's a lot of track clubs that like to recruit post-collegiate athletes to continue their track and field career.
Got it.
So when there was some coaches in LA, they found out that I was moving back to LA. One guy linked me up with a guy named Malachi Davis.
Okay.
And he's right now the curtain coach for Sydney McLaughlin, the 400 meter hurdler.
Yeah.
So when I got with him, you know, I was training with him.
Got it.
But because of Malachi, he used to run for Great Britain in the Olympics. He had a lot of connections.
Yeah.
And training with him, there's a lot of, a lot of agency recruiters from the Nike talent agency, they'll come, they'll watch the athletes, and I have a very, very distinctive look that they like.
Did you have the mohawk back then?
Yeah.
The full hawk?
Mm-hmm.
Nice, man.
Yeah, they like that. They like that aesthetic, so they recruited me to do a particular commercial.
Okay.
It was very, very successful, and it got me more jobs. Right. So the problem is that you need to know somebody to know somebody.
Yeah.
You know, to get jobs like that, it's unfortunate that you can't just go to the internet, submit your name, and hope for a callback.
Right.
You got to be in the community.
Yeah.
I remember a lady from the LinkedIn, from LinkedIn, she reached out to me asking, hey, how do you connect with Nike? And I told her specifically, you need to go to the events. When Nike have like a combine, you need to go there and show your face.
Right.
Nike has some type of like pop light where they're like, you know, they're showing off their new gear, you need to come there, show your face, and meet the people who put an event together and connect with them so you can find any opportunities that they may have that they can submit yourself into.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really cool aspect for you, hearing from the athlete side of things. how you booked that commercial. Because from the pure acting side of things, you know, going through the audition, the callback, and then, you know, hopefully booking that spot, it's a little different. And I have my athletic background, but it's really cool to see that they're putting athletes in a position to thrive based on their actual abilities.
Yes.
You know, you're actually capable of running very fast and looking explosive on camera. And I see the work that you do in the gym. It's not just the aesthetics, it's the movement and the ability to not just be an ornament, but be a an object that works and moves and is proficient in your movements. That's really cool to see.
Yes, thank you.
So really cool. So you come from the track background. Are you still running?
Absolutely.
You're still pretty quick?
Oh, of course.
Because here's the thing. I always said if I was to be a track guy, 100 meter would be what I'm okay at. I can give you 100, 200, maybe 3, and then I start to gas out. But I'm pretty explosive off the jump. I would like to see us, you know, retired collegiate athlete, me a little bit younger, but explosive. I would like to see us see what we got on the track. I would like to see what we got on the track one day. I don't have track shoes or anything like that, so you got to coach me on how to break them in and get some track shoes. But I'd like to race one day, bro.
Absolutely.
And just see what we're working with, man, because
it'd be an honor.
I think that would be really cool to see. So, okay, tell me a little bit more about some of the challenges that you faced. You have a lot of good things going on right now with your production company, with your massage company, and you also are, you know, doing a great job as far as the fitness goes. You keep yourself in incredible shape. Tell me a little bit about the challenges that led up to that. You know, I know you had experienced homelessness. I know you had experienced job loss. I know you have experienced relationship, you know, positives and negatives over the years. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about that and how you overcame that and got to where you are right now.
I always say that the brain is the most important muscle in the human body. The challenge is just mindset. Yeah. Wake up in the morning knowing that you have these obstacles. How do you proceed on tackling them?
Yeah.
And how do you learn from them and grow from them? You know, like we said in our last podcast, like, LA is a beast. It's a tough town.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's going through something. Everybody have their challenges. Everybody have their demons.
Yeah.
Everybody have their turmoils. Everybody have their, you know, their mountains that need to climb.
Yeah.
So, like, when it comes to challenges for me, is mindset.
Definitely.
You know, so, like, I wake up in the morning knowing that I have a obstacle I need to tackle, like a depth I need to tackle.
Yeah.
You know, the first thing I need to think about is execution.
Right.
What are the jobs that I need to achieve in order for me to execute this depth?
Yeah.
And what I need to do in order for me to accumulate more capital, to have more capital to cover this depth over and over and over again, and most essentially cover my other depths so I can stay up the float. Because LA is very expensive. Like you say, you got to have 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 jobs in order for you to make it here.
Yeah, man. Yeah, one time I was doing 5. Yeah. One time I was doing 5. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, so when it comes to mindset, education, you know, say the ability to get up every day and learn something new every day is one of the most important abilities that I adapt to as far as living in LA go. Because when I learn something, I learn new skill sets.
Yeah.
And not only do I learn new skill sets, I learn more about somebody, like my clients.
Yeah,
like I need to learn more about my clients each and every single day so I can make sure that they get the full Brian West experience.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they know that, hey, I like that's how I achieve the intuition.
Absolutely.
Like when they're training, I feel what they feel.
Yeah.
You know, say I know what they're thinking.
Yeah.
And before they even ask a question, I already have the answer.
Mm.
So like I said, mindset and the ability to learn something new each and every single day is not only just a challenge, but it's a virtue.
Yeah, definitely, man. I remember watching the Arnold Schwarzenegger documentary, and he talks about how he's not a self-made man and how there is a blueprint to be successful. And I thought, wow, coming from a guy like Arnold from Austria who had nothing, mm-hmm. you know, for him to say that he's not a self-made man, there's something to that. So in my calendar every week, I actually have, it's an event that I do on Tuesdays every week. Study a great / there is a blueprint. To remind myself, there's a blueprint of the people who have done it before you.
Mm-hmm.
the people that are where you want to be, the people that are headed where you want to head. And with that in mind, every single week, I study a great. It could be a 5-minute article that I read. It could be a video that I watch. It could be anything. I could read a book, study a great, and there is a blueprint. So I love what you're saying. Learn something new every day from somebody who's done it, who's been there. And there's a blueprint to this stuff. And it's not copying them. It's using their format that has worked and applying it to your ultimate goals.
Execution.
Absolutely, brother. Executing. So we talked about some of the challenges you've been through. We've talked about who you are as a person. Something that's challenging you, even though you're having success on many levels right now, mm-hmm. What's something that you're currently being challenged with, even in today's day and age?
Being the man. And when I mean by the man, I mean being the man, where when you work at a location, you're the man that everybody looks up to. If you're like the captain of a football team, the captain of a basketball team, you're the Kobe Bryant of the Los Angeles Lakers. Mm-hmm. Being the man was something that I was always placed to be, but a long time ago, I couldn't understand how to execute it because, you know, I didn't have the knowledge on how to be the man.
Yeah.
And what I mean by being the man, being the alpha, yeah. Being the tier one guy, being the president, the guy who called the shots.
Yeah.
And you go into a place where you do business at, you make a commitment as being the man, you say to yourself that I am the best at what I do. I'm very, very great at what I do. I was very, very naive and foolish to believe that if I was to create this mind, if this frame of thinking, I'm gonna have a lot of supporters.
Mm.
However, what I end up learning is that when you become the best at what you do, when you become very, very good at what you do, you become a very, very dangerous man. One, people will rely on you to a point where, like, they'll call you at 1 o'clock in the morning and be like, hey, I need an answer to this.
Yeah.
And they pay you so much money to where you cannot ignore that call.
Right, right.
Somebody who knows about your work, they offer you a job. They don't like saying, they don't want to hear a no from you.
Yeah.
You got to figure out how to make it work.
Yeah.
You go into a place where, you know, you call yourself the best personal trainer in LA. You go to a gym full of personal trainers who train millionaires, billionaires, and they see how you operate, see how you execute. There's going to be a field of trainers who is going to admire you. And there's going to be a lot of trainers who's going to, you know, they're going to test you. And it's not necessarily them talking about you. It's about how they react when they're around you.
Right.
Like, you know, one time I was training my client and another trainer was training her client, and that client was within a vicinity of my other client, so I had to figure out how to pivot, because I'm in a position where if I was to address this to this trainer, she can use this information to the gym owner, mm-hmm. as leverage against me to hurt my business at the gym. So like Winston Churchill said that you cannot throw a bone at every dog that barks at you. So there's sometimes you gotta, like I said, you gotta pivot. Mm. And you have to adapt, and you have to create some type of concept where you can provide your clients the full experience, even though this turmoil is going on.
Yeah.
So that challenge has been very, very difficult. And going back to being the best trainer in LA, you go to the best gym in LA or in the world, you go to Gold's Gym, people will see you in that segment, but it doesn't mean that they're going to look up to you. They see you as competitive, kind of like you said earlier.
Yeah.
LA is very competitive. If everybody in here is trying to be the best at what they do. Not a lot of people understand diplomacy. They don't understand collaboration. They want to take whatever they can get for themselves and move forward to whatever destination they're going through. And when I found out about that, I learned not to take things personally.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Just, you know, if I get hired for a job, do the job, execute, give them the best I can get, and move forward.
Definitely.
But whatever positive relationships that I, you know, cross into, I make sure to stay tight with it, like us.
Yeah, absolutely, man. And what I'm hearing is there's a lot of responsibility that comes with being the best at any specific field. A lot of responsibility comes with that. People are gonna put a target on your back,
yeah.
And they are gonna look at you as a guy that you're up there, so they wanna bring you down. And if they're trying to bring you down, they're already beneath you, you know? So that's how I like to look at things. But there's a lot of responsibility that comes with that. And what you're saying about the competitiveness, there needs to be a healthy competition, you know. I'd love to race you the 100-yard dash, you know, 100-meter dash. You know, a healthy competition is always good. It keeps us sharp. It keeps us on our game. But the collaboration aspect is something that a lot of people don't tap into fully based on their ego. There's enough out there for everybody. You know, there's enough financial gain. There's enough great clients. There's enough good opportunities out there for everyone. And if you're authentically you, you know, those opportunities are gonna come to you. They're gonna flow to you. You're gonna take advantage of them. You're gonna capitalize on them. You're gonna grow. Being jealous of somebody else and listening to that egotistical demon inside you is never a good thing. So I love where you're coming from with the collaborative approach. It is competitive. It is challenging. I think iron sharpens iron. It's a good thing that it's challenging here in LA. You're navigating it quite well. I see you collaborating with some of the best people in the fitness industry. Charles Glass, we were just talking about, the godfather of bodybuilding. Guys like that respect you. And that's one of the coolest things, is when you see really established people in the fitness industry and in industry in general. You know, we talked about last time on your podcast how I met 50 Cent in the gym at Gold's. You know, to walk up to a guy like 50 Cent and he tells me, he goes, damn, I got to get my size up. And I'm 19 years old, you know, at Gold Gym, and I meet a guy like 50 Cent and he says, I got to get my size up. This is a guy, I see the Massacre album. He looks massive. You know, a guy that I look up to and looked up to, especially as a young kid. And for him to say that was like validation for me at 19. I was like, I'm going to be somebody, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's really cool to have that collaborative approach. It's really cool to see people respect you. I've always respected you from the day I met you with your big mohawk. Now you got the smaller hawk coming in. And that leads me to my next question. So I know you told me, and I never really touched on it a whole lot with you, you told me that your mohawk was a spiritual thing for you. So can you tell me a little bit more about that? Me, I got the pompadour, I got the comb over. To me, it's, you know, I used to be a barber back in the day. So to me, it's a sharp haircut. It's my look. It's the clean cut look. Maybe I could be a little bit edgy sometimes, but for the most part, clean cut look. Now, tell me about your mohawk and how that's a spiritual thing for you. So I'm so interested about that.
So it's the mohawk is it's an identity thing, a spiritual thing. It goes way back to when I was in the second, third grade, when I was in Catholic school. You know, I was trying to understand who I am. You know, I'm black. I'm in this reality. You know, I'm in Los Angeles. So I had the privilege to, you know my grandmother, know my grandfather, know my great-great-grandmother. Wow. And, you know, they would sit me down. They would tell me about my ancestors. You know, that was something that was very, very fascinating because, you know, you go to school, you learn history, and you learn history from what the institution wants you to know about history. And when it comes to history, the most important thing that I was looking to was, who am I in this history? And the history books, I always identify me as some sort of like slave picking cotton in the fields, which is true. That is a reality. I had a lot of ancestors who were in that world, but my grandmother told me that you had ancestors who came from Europe, and you had ancestors who are already here in the Americas. And the ancestors that who are here in the Americas, they will be classified as quote-unquote Native American. So, like, when she showed me pictures of them, you know, they had the mohawk, you know, they had that, you know, the features, you know, the Native American features. But what was interesting was, you know, they were in unit with, you know, how the curtain group of Native Americans that we see every day.
Yeah.
Like, they were intertwined with each other. And it became more understanding when I was at Arizona State, when I pledged my fraternity. We started having collaborations with other organizations. One specific organization was a Native American organization. And, you know, it was one of those things where they say, hey, you need to sit down and you need to learn something new. And when they started teaching me some stuff, it was very difficult to process.
Yeah.
You know, this is when I was still young. I didn't really quite understand who I was. I was still trying to understand where I fit and within with society. But when they were telling me history, I was like, shit, I need to start over. I need to reread some books. I need to
rewire. Yeah.
And one of the most important things that I did was I studied the discovery of America through the Portuguese and the Spanish lens.
Okay.
That was very, very important for me to go down that rabbit hole because they take race out of the context.
Right.
They say, hey, look, Christopher Columbus, the guys that he brought over to Americas to, you know, discover America, they were Jewish, they were black, they were guys that looked like you, they were guys that looked like me. But the thing was that they were in debt within the king for Spain at the time, the king and queen at the time. You know, the thing was that the Islamic culture and the Mongols, they were getting too close to Europe. So the Catholic Church needed to figure something out quick. Mm-hmm. So Pope Nicholas V, you know, he signed his Papa Bull to where, hey, whoever you find in the Americas, convert them to Catholicism. Period.
Right.
To save, you know, to save the faith because the Mongols and Islam, they were getting too close to specifically the Vatican.
Right.
So when I went down that rabbit hole, I started to focus mostly on guys that looked like me, and they had the Mohawk, they had this warrior spirit that I always been fascinated into, but most essentially, not just the Native Americans, but the Europeans that looked like me that was in Europe at the time, they were crusaders, you know, and they were specifically in, was it Bavaria in Germany?
Got it.
And the reason why I learned about them is because the Mongols, they got as far as Poland go. And they were so destructive that the Catholic Church, you know, they brought everybody in to take on the Mongols. The Teutonic Knights, there were other crusader groups that got kind of like written out of history books, but the most important crusader groups that we always hear about is the Knights of Templar, Knights of Malta, and some of the subgroups within that group. But the history books will always say that, you know, they're all white and stuff like that. But the Arabs, they were very honest with me, you know, back at Arizona State. They said the crusaders were recruited from all over the place. You know, it was kind of like Rome.
Okay.
You know, they invade a country, the strongest seeds, they fight under Rome.
Okay.
Otherwise, they be thrown in the Colosseum and, you know, they're getting fed by the lions and shit like and stuff like that. So when I learned more about that, it was a slowly process. You know, I had the privilege to know my grandfather, my mother's father. He is half Native American, half black. He's, up in North Florida, Florida State, Seminole.
Okay.
Seminole. So he, you know, his hair went all the way down to his feet.
Wow.
Yeah, it was like, and when I see that, I was like, yeah, you're the only guy that I know that can do that.
And he was half Native American and half
black.
Black. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Half black, half Native American. So, you know, when I learned more about that in 2014, that's when I made the decision to start this Mohawk journey.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to be connected with my ancestors.
I love that. And you chose to be connected with the ancestors that painted the picture that you wanted to paint.
100%.
Being a crusader, being a badass, and being one of these guys. You didn't want to be
a slave.
You chose not to be a victim.
100%.
You chose not to live with that mentality of, I can't do or I can't be. And instead you decided to go out there and be exactly what you wanted to be, and you continue to do that. That's fascinating to me.
Yeah,
I never knew. Did you ever speak about that publicly?
No.
About the Mohawk? Or
no? This,
well,
is,
this
very,
is great. This,
yeah,
is
this
great
is very
to have.
Very difficult to talk about because, again, with the institution that we live in, you know, I'm black. I sit in classroom. I get a book. You open it. You see guys like me picking cotton in the field. We're getting hanged by trees. We're getting burned. So, like, that constant visual was something that, you know, when I remember processing it, I was confused. Yeah. I was like, okay, like...
How old were you? Like, if you had to say, like, 8, 9, 10, about 9 years old, where it really started to affect you.
Yeah.
Sort of stuff.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Okay,
so, another thing that I would touch into that got me into the books for me to understand who I am was when I was in the third grade... I met Father Shelton. He was my guardian at the time at St. Anselm Catholic Church in Los Angeles, California. You know, I just asked him, hey, man, like, has there ever been an angel go down to hell, and then he went from hell back up to heaven. And he said, yes, Brian, Angel has done that before. And I asked him, has there ever been a devil that went from hell up to heaven? And he said, yes, there has been many, many devils that went from hell up to heaven. And I remember he said to me, he said, Brian, you know, you're going to be a very, very intelligent man when you get older. Because this type of language at third grade is a sense of curiosity.
Right.
You know, like, fuck, like, who am I? You know, I'm in a Catholic church. The church is telling me one thing, but I'm seeing different things. And with that, you know, and that led to me understanding, you know, asking my grandmother, my grandfather, hey, who are my ancestors? But most essentially, who did they worship before Christianity and Catholicism? And that's what got me into learning about, okay, were there black people in Europe before Christopher Columbus or, you know, back in the, you know, medieval times?
Yeah.
Which is right. And when I went into that rabbit hole, I learned that there's a lot of history that's not been talked about.
Yeah.
Going back to what I said earlier, the Mongols, they were close.
Yeah.
That side of history has not been talked about well enough in a English-speaking world. But if you go to Saudi Arabia, if you go to India, and if you go to China, like, the Mongols, like, they have an extremely important position in world history.
Yeah.
To where, like, they had a lot of influence on how the Europeans were reacting towards coming to the Americas.
Yeah.
And also, their military campaigns. Like, the English-speaking world doesn't do a good job classifying how they operate. You know, they're very, very classified as very, very barbarian. Mm-hmm. But they're very, very intelligent. Like, they were so intelligent that they were, like I said, they were close. They had all of Asia.
Yeah.
They dominated the Russians to a point where, like, that's one of some of the saddest stories I've ever went into as far as history go. And my theory on why Russia is what it is right now is because of what they did. Same thing with India. India, when the Mongols Genghis Khan, he did not go to India, but it was a guy after him many, many years ago. His name is Timur. He went into India, and he raised war against that culture, and there are groups who got wiped out of the history books.
Yeah.
To where, like, you know, India, my theory on India, why did they go through what they went through with Britain, is because the groups that they had before Timur was there, you know, they were gone. They were like their spiritual advisors and stuff like that. Because India, they're very consistent when it comes to their religion.
Right. And what's amazing about that is we read and learn what's in the books.
Mm-hmm.
What's in the history books, what's on the internet, what we have access to. What people tend to forget, we're in year 2025. But this earth, they estimate it's been here for 13.4 billion years. Billion. If you try to rationalize that in your mind, it's amazing. There could have been whole entire societies that were here and wiped off the face of the earth. And then here again and wiped off the face of the earth. And we really don't know everything about the past on an even larger level than you diving deeper into the history books and seeing the world the way you want to perceive it. In a sense, and finding those things that are less taught. And I just, kudos to you, man, going out there, finding role models within your ancestry, and finding those crusaders, I'm learning a lot from you today, man. It's a blessing to hear these conversations. And after this podcast, these are things I'm gonna look into because I'm a curious person myself.
Yeah.
You know?
And this is very, very difficult to talk about because within my culture, Black American culture, you know, we're very, very Christian-based. If you speak outside of the Christian circle, then, you know, you're going to be called a lot of names. You're going to be judged.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to the identity thing, we all are institutionalized to identify a very, very specific group of our ancestors, which is, you know, the ones who were enslaved.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, like, I think what's important for me is not only do I look into my ancestors who are in Europe and in Americas, but also my ancestors who were enslaved, what did they have to endure in order for me to sit in this chair in front of you right now? And then every single day, going back to what you said, what are my challenges? My challenge is waking up in the morning when it comes to mindset, knowing that I need to learn how to be more grateful because my ancestors didn't have what I have.
Yeah.
You know, so I get up in the morning, you know, I have some of the best clients in the world.
Yeah.
I get to give them the best version of myself. And when they're with me, they say, hey, Brian's my friend. He is my trainer.
Yeah.
Versus back in their day, yeah, they didn't get that title.
Right.
They don't even get a name.
Yeah.
And when I don't, or let them know, they don't even get, you know, any well attention to make sure that they're taken care of. It's also important for me to learn. So, like, when it comes to the subject of slavery, my grandmother, my father's mother, my beloved grandmother, I miss her, I call her Sweet Thing. Mm. You know, she was honest. She said, hey, Brian, you have white ancestors. And she told me about my Irish grandfather, my great-grand-grandfather, Irish. His name is Jock Childress.
Okay.
You know, he came from Ireland with a black wife. And she validated, hey, there were black people in Ireland in the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th century.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And what led to them migrating to the Americas was the English Civil War. The Irish population at the time were being enslaved by the English. And, you know, there was the people of Ireland, you know, their main source of food was potatoes. So the one
Irish
time.
Irish potatoes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So well, there was
Idaho potatoes, but I guess Irish potatoes as well. It's like a thing.
So I'll tell you about that. A lot of those people migrated to Idaho.
Oh, really?
Because when it came to the Americas, the Manifest Destiny was a new thing.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of those settlers who was migrating westward were from Ireland. They had no land.
Yeah.
They had no money. They had nothing. Oh, so, but the only thing that they heard was land.
Yeah.
So, like, when they heard, hey, go west, they went west, and they settled in Idaho.
Ah, there you go.
Because they brought their education from Ireland, which, unfortunately for them, they dealt with an extremely bad famine that had a lot of them die from starvation. And one of the most sensitive things that I've never, and it really molded my mindset of how government works, was when the people of Ireland were going through this famine, the British would send guys with guns, military uniforms, knock on their door and be like, hey, do you have any food? Do you have any money? If you do, you need to give it to us right now, because the British were their quote-unquote protectors, or the government above the people of Ireland.
Taxation.
Yeah.
Taxation, brother.
So, like, when she explained that to me, it helped me understand that, hey, we're not the only ones that's being oppressed. And the reason why this is very difficult to talk about is because if you say this to somebody with my own skin color, this, what I just said, they will find it very, very offensive, and they'll argue with me to the T. Like you said, the victim mentality, it's a philosophy within my culture. It's something that is very, very, very ingrained in our collective consciousness, to where in order for you to break out of that consciousness, you got to be an individual. You need to find a group or an individual that you can identify with that has an identity where you can overcome this victimization philosophy.
Got it.
And what helped me was understanding, hey, the people of Ireland, they suffered. People in China suffered in the 1930s over Japanese rule. Going back to India, when Timur came into India, you know, they suffered greatly, to where there were very, very important groups in that culture that got wiped out of the face of the earth, to where when the British came, they had no protection. And going back to the Native Americans, like, their strongest men were dominated by the Europeans.
Right.
Not by physical force, by the mind.
Right. So you talk about these things, and I'm learning as you're speaking. And there's some of these things and concepts that I've heard of. But this to me is very intriguing, the philosophy and mentality that you have, and the way you've been able to spin all of this knowledge into a positive for you. You choose to live a life where you rise. We talk about the Rise with Levine podcast. You're rising with Levine. People are rising with Brian Williams. And because of this knowledge, you've armed yourself with the tools to push forward and realize that I could be whatever it is that I want to be.
And it's very, very important to be in an environment that allows you to be that.
Definitely, man. Definitely. Love what you're saying here. Really good stuff overall. So if you had one piece of advice to help the audience rise in their life, one singular piece of advice, what would that be?
Learn something new every day.
Learn something
it can
new
be the smallest things. The smallest thing that you learn Well, it's like a snowball effect.
Yeah.
5 months from now, 10 months from now, a year from now, 12 years from now, that knowledge that you learned from that day will morph into something that will make you powerful.
Yeah. Incredible, man. Well, hey, Brian, it's been great. As you said, one way to help people rise is going to be to learn something new every day. And I couldn't agree more. You know, like I said, I got that thing in my calendar. Every week, I remind myself to learn something new. Every day, I want to learn something new. But Brian, it's been an absolute pleasure, man. Thank you for coming. Thank you for being a good friend. Thank you for being somebody that I could always rely on. We'll do this again sometime soon. Now we're going to go get a workout in, smash the iron up a little bit.
Hell yeah.
But it's been a pleasure, bro.
Anthony.
All right, man.
Thank you, my brother.